This is the Tan Talk Radio Network.
Hi, this is Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. Coming to you from glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. And I am here in the studio of Tan Talk Radio Network, and I am so happy that Bill Larson, our legal eagle, is here with me. Hi, Bill.
Good morning.
Okay, it's always fun when you're in here. Wow. A change of weather, huh?
Yeah, it's cold.
Oh, wow. I asked my brother, of course, lives in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, and I said, send us some cold weather. So, everyone, you can blame him.
Not that cold.
No, not that cold. Not that cold. But anyway, it's a nice change. We need a little bit of change once in a while. Oh, it is. You know, I just love all you writers out there. You come out with such interesting problems, questions, and you're sending me, I love the grammar questions, I love the questions about plotting, and I love when you have an intellectual property question, or you just want to know more about copyrights, because that is what you need to know about when you are a writer. And one of the questions, Bill, actually, it's very funny. She's thinking now, she's been listening to the program, you know, for a long time, and she's been thinking about copyrights, and so now she's got a sort of an idea for a mystery about copyrights, and she's planning to see how she can integrate that into a mystery story about a stolen copyright. And so then she asked me, well, what actually happens to the copyright of course, she's younger, so she doesn't know. In the olden days, 1 cent physically. And a lot of people don't know that. A lot of you young people don't understand that people actually sent letters, and they sent their entire book.
Yes.
Can you imagine Thomas Wolfe's book, like 900 pages arriving? And what? She wants to know, what did they do with them? Where are they?
In the Library of Congress.
Okay, now, for all of, and the Library of Congress has been doing this for a long time.
For a long time.
Have you been to the original office?
Yes, it's
isn't
beautiful.
It beautiful?
Absolutely gorgeous.
Anyone who goes to Washington, D.C. should go to the original copyright and patent office. It is one of the loveliest rooms. I was thinking how wonderful it must have been just to work there.
Yeah, historic.
It's just beautiful. So people sent in their entire books. And
they went on the shelf, and they received a number.
And
the Library of Congress stored the book as a reference.
Now, are they still there?
Yes.
So the original books are still there?
Yes.
Somewhere. No, they must have them in a big, major storage.
Yeah, they have major storage now.
Underground, couple miles long.
Right.
But they have the original.
Right. They have all those originals dating back to the beginning of our country.
I had not thought about that. I know I had registered a few of my works, in that form with hard copies sent to them. So it never occurred to me that they actually still have them.
They keep those paper copies. But, of course, now we're going to a digital format. So when you file your copyright work, it's in a PDF, and it's filed electronically, kept digitally.
Probably isn't as much fun. But
no. Easier for the lawyers.
Yes.
When I file it, because everything now is online. So I just go to the copyright office, fill out the form for my client, submit the fee, and then upload the digital copy of the work to be copyrighted. And then I get a receipt back from the copyright office. And next thing you know, you're registered.
But have you ever had to actually go and get...
Well, in the old days we did. We filed everything in paper before the advent of the internet and digital
So
electronics.
You've gone and seen...
Physically,
yeah.
Get a stamp. This old stamp.
That's very exciting. Now, who can see these?
Anybody.
Anybody can go?
That's right. Anybody can go to the Library of Congress and look at this stuff. It belongs to we the people.
So, if I wanted to see... It's hard to imagine that they fit. You could physically go and see it. What's the process? You have to.
You go there, and you probably have to make an appointment. Particularly if you have very valuable pieces, you know, they don't want people touching them, running through them, because they break down.
Yeah.
All right. The oil's on your hands and stuff. So a lot of these old manuscripts and stuff, they want to keep kind of just.
When I was living in England, and I did a lot of research with old newspapers, and they had a special room where we had to wear gloves and right. and
because
to turn the
atmosphere
the page.
And the oils on your hand will just destroy the parchment and the ink and all that stuff. But now everything's being digitized, so you would just go and you just open up a digital file and read it. But yes, all of those original works have been stored. It is one of the greatest accumulations of knowledge in the world.
Well, her question was, and this is where she has sort of an idea for a mystery, that somebody who is now famous is going to be running for the president of the United States. When he was younger, he wrote some salacious material that he copyrighted. At the time, he thought he was going to be a writer, mm-hmm. and he was a hippie.
Yeah.
And now he's going to run for president, and he wants to get rid of that material.
Right.
In her idea for her book, he's going around killing people, anybody who had
access to it. Yeah.
Who he had.
Yeah,
he never actually published anything, but he did copyright it.
Yeah.
But he did give copies to his friends, and they were hippies in the days.
Yeah, good old days.
In the good old days. And so he's going around finding everybody who ever read any of his stuff and destroying it. And,
right.
and since sometimes
can't do that anymore, but you could in the days when it was just paper.
Sometimes he had to kill people.
Mm-hmm.
So that it's a nice idea, but if it's there in the copyright, so she says, but the thing is, it's in the, how is he going to get into destroyed in the copyright?
Very, very good plot.
Huh?
Yeah, it's a great plot.
So
great idea.
That's an interesting idea, huh?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And we got to remember that salacious material is copyrightable just as non-salacious material. So even pornography is protected by copyright.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
There's no distinction just because it's something you don't like. You know, it's not copyrighted.
Yeah, they don't actually – well, maybe. I don't know.
They will take a look at it to see if it meets the minimum requirements of copywriting. So, for instance, if you just write a sentence on a piece of paper, I walked to the store this morning and send that in as a copyright, it'll be rejected because it doesn't meet that minimum amount of originality, they say.
But then in the olden days, if they were sitting there reading a book right through it, and you'd say, oh, okay.
Remember, copyrights only applied to books and manuscripts early on, but as history has gone by, and they've added music, right?
Yeah.
Right, and then they've added computer software, and then photographs. So the copyright laws have developed and kind of been a little bit behind science, but we keep adding to the copyright laws to protect things other than just works of authorship, which was the only thing that was originally in the Copyright Act.
And talking about software, now that is a complicated part of intellectual property.
It's one of the toughest things to copyright,
very complex. Because having had
like
a company...
Thousands of lines of code.
Yes, having had a company in where we had really millions of lines of code, and when people have to compare that, it must be mind-boggling.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It must be absolute. But it's really exciting. I sort of thought they registered it and threw it away. I had no idea.
No. Everything's retained, so it's.
We're up to
greatest collection of works in the world, on the planet.
It's exciting. Yes, I would think that you need to register in advance because I don't think they keep. I mean, they have to somewhere find these documents to bring them. You know, like a
mm-hmm.
but you could just. I mean, it's exciting. You can, it's amazing.
It's a great history, and it's really interesting that the United States Constitution, originally drafted, incorporated copyright protection in the original Constitution. So it was obviously very important to the founders of the country, and it went through and remained in the Constitution without objection by anybody.
Well, why were they so involved with it? Someone else asked me, another listener said, well, she thought that they had copyright laws in Rome.
No, they didn't. No. This is where
they just poisoned each other. If somebody stole my poem,
Okay. Not copyrights as in the sense that we think of them today, okay? And you have to remember that the founders of the country were very literate and very rich, and they did a lot of writing, so it was in their own favor to have copyright laws. Remember back when the country first started, a majority of the population was illiterate. All right. Very few people could read, so it wasn't a big deal for most people. But for the founders, they're writing all the time, so they clearly understood that they needed to protect their works of authorship because they didn't want everybody else copying or using them in a manner that they didn't approve of. And so that's how it started. It was really the folks who were actually needed the protection stuck it in the Constitution.
And that just shows why our founders were so brilliant.
And patents were in there also because they were also inventors. And so copyrights and patents are in Article 1 of our Constitution.
It really shows the importance, and it shows
to our country.
Really how brilliant they were that they thought of this.
The forethought, yes, and not knowing where it would go because they had no idea type of technology we would have today.
You know, just watching recently the John Adams series, and you see that, wow, these people
They just sat around and wrote all day long. Yeah. That's all they did, Benjamin Franklin, Thomas. I mean, they just wrote and wrote and wrote and wrote and wrote and read and read and read. That's all they did.
Yeah, and
very smart people,
and we're very grateful. Now, thinking of that, Lady Gaga and Madonna are in a fight right now. Did you hear about this?
I think I heard about that. Yeah.
A sentence.
Over a sentence. Yeah.
Yes, Madonna thinks Lady Gaga stole her sentence.
Maybe a lyric, a line, or a lyric.
No, just a sentence. Okay. A sentence about.
So there's a question of whether a single sentence is copyrightable, protectable, and you could stop somebody. So sounds a little dubious. I haven't looked into it deeply, but you got to wonder, is this really what the purpose of copyright is, to protect a single sentence?
Yeah, it's funny, but I guess...
We have trademark laws to protect sentences, okay, if they're applied to a product, like the real thing for Coke, just do it, Nike. All right, and so you can protect sentences,
I use that. Just do it. Sometimes when I tell people, right, just do it. So I'm in trouble.
No.
No. Okay.
Because you're just using it in a completely generic fashion.
So, but it is funny how Madonna's really angry about it.
She thought there could be a lot of money at stake, and that's usually.
Yeah, she came out with a clever sentence, and she wants it. She wants it back. I think also maybe she wants her youth back because, you know, when you
so
get
do old, I.
Yeah, don't we all? So it's funny. I just love when.
There were some other great questions here that came in. What was the other one?
Oh yeah,
they wanted to know about some of the lawsuits going on.
Oh well, this is Cassandra Clare's lawyer. Have you heard about if the trial went forward or if they settled it?
I have not heard that the trial went forward yet.
Yeah.
I have not heard that it has. It's probably still in the pretrial stages.
Okay, so this has to do with Dark Hunter, and again, you know. An author comes out with an idea and has her characters and has her descriptions, which are general concepts,
which are not protectable. General concepts are not protectable.
But on the other hand, if, for example, I thought this was funny because, you know, coming from Northern Michigan where flannel shirts are big. I mean, everybody wears.
They're coming back in now.
And everybody wears flannel shirts up there. And yeah, you're right. They're coming back here. And today, I think people could pull out their flannel shirts. It would be
warm.
It would be a good day here in our area. But so she describes her character as wears flannel shirts. Well, of course, he lives in a rural area, so that's not unusual. But in the other one, the one that is claimed to be a copy or infringement, the guy wears flannel shirts, but he lives in the city.
Still a concept. Yeah. It's not specific enough.
So, you know, that they have blue eyes with dark hair.
I mean, if you want to, you can compare any two works and find some similarities of some kind.
Uh-huh.
But the courts are very clear that they need specifics. They really need to have characters with particular attributes specific themes in order to be an infringement. Because just because two pieces of work are the same doesn't mean there's an infringement. You know, a lot of times it's a coincidence because people use these common themes. There has to be a direct copying. There has to be access to the work, and then that person has to take that work and derive it into something else, and what they come up with afterwards, that derivative, has to be substantially similar, and that's where the rubber hits the road in infringement cases.
Now, do we have sometimes public trials here in Florida?
We do. Yeah, the federal courthouse in Tampa.
And how like this woman who wants to write a mystery, how do you find out when a trial is coming up?
Well, it's not published it's not of great interest to most people. What you would do is you could get you can sign up and get some software that looks through all of the cases, and you take the trial calendar and you find out when the trial go forward. So there's a way. We lawyers know how to do it. We can look and see when a trial is going to go forward based on the scheduling order of the judge.
So you can find.
But I'll tell you, in all of my trials, you rarely see people come in. There's maybe one or two watch. It's just not that exciting.
Well, and are these trials generally with a jury? With the jury?
Yeah, yes, jury.
And you get to ask the jury if they read books and if...
Voir dire, yes. Yeah, so before you pick your jury, you're allowed to ask them a bunch of questions. Who are you? Do you like this? You know, a bunch of questions to see where they are. And then typically if there's a couple that you think that are not going to vote your way based on the answers to your questions, you strike them.
Well, everybody who's seen Dr. Bull now, this television show, now knows all about trial prep. You know, it's a big deal. But I assume you do your own? Yes, or you... Do you hire trial prep doctors?
Yes, we use trial preparation experts, jury consultants, because now everything is digital in trials. Everything's presented on a computer, on a big screen. There's no papers anymore. So everything's digital. And yes, we use vendors to do all of that because I need to concentrate on making my legal arguments and asking my questions to the witnesses.
Okay. And would you, if you were doing a trial and somebody said, I haven't read a book in years, would that make a difference?
No, not necessarily. No. I'm looking for somebody who's impartial, who's
open-minded.
Who's open-minded but is going to follow the letter of the law as the judge describes at the end of the case, and that they'll only base their verdict on the facts that are in the case and not facts that they may have heard otherwise. And if a person can be fair and impartial that way, it doesn't make a difference to me.
So it doesn't matter
if they're well-read or not.
If they're, yeah.
Sometimes know-it-alls are the worst ones on your jury because they just want to take over and they want to push their opinion on the other jury members. And so we try to weed those dark horses out.
Yeah, and then, of course, if there's like two books and they have to read both of them, maybe they like to plagiarize one better, you know, because the nice thing with if you're going to plagiarize a book, you might be able to improve, you know, on it. You say, okay, well, I can do a little bit better on that. So
then
you'd be in trouble, right?
Yes, you could be in trouble. So it's very interesting. Juries typically get it right. Let me tell you, they're you know, average folks, average Americans. You know, in other countries like in Europe, they have special juries for these things, professional jury members
who decide these things,
you know, judges or so. But here in the United States, of course, you have the constitutional right to a jury by your peers. So you just get your neighbors and your average folks. I've had everything from nuclear scientists to just your school teacher to every kind of occupation that you can imagine. And they see through the BS, okay? Let me tell you, don't try to pull it over on the jury because they'll see right through you. And they typically get it right.
Well, I think that's a great thing.
I think it's a great system, and it works.
It is. I think.
Best system in the world.
Because I wouldn't want a jury of just people who judge all day long. That, you know, and you never know who could influence them.
Yeah. And so I have a great deal of faith in the jury system in the United States and the people that live here in the Tampa Bay area that sit on my juries.
That's fantastic. Well, it's so much fun when I'm talking to writers and they're so enthusiastic. And as I've been telling them, you know, now when I go to meetings, and I was recently at a writer's meeting, and more and more are with the changes of how they publish, many are self-published.
Yes.
They are now getting the idea, and even the ones who have an agent are starting to understand that they have to take so much responsibility in their own hands.
Yes.
to ensure that their copyrights are done properly.
Right.
And to ensure if they have a trademarkable thing that they can.
Because if you're going to do a series of books, you can trademark the name as long as it's a series.
And which is a.
We talked about that previously.
Yes, and a great idea.
So a lot of times the legal stuff's overlooked because it is boring and it's confusing and sometimes expensive. And, you know, it's the least exciting part of your project of writing a book and getting it out there. And so it's overlooked a lot of times. And that's a shame because it's so important because once the cat's out of the bag, you can really lose a lot of rights.
Yes.
So one of the things we have in copyright law is published versus unpublished works, okay? And an unpublished work is one that's not been sold yet, okay? Or it could just still be secret to that author. And so once it's published, if you don't have your copyright application before publication, which is your first sale, or within a certain amount of time, you sacrifice a huge amount of protection rights, okay? So that's why it's so important to register your copyright early on, particularly in the unpublished stage before you've sold it to anybody. Once you say it's done, the next thing you do is you call your copyright lawyer, you send them the work, we file it, get the copyright. Now you can go do anything you want to do without losing any of your rights. Statutory damages, attorney's fees, and all the bells and whistles that we lawyers love as plaintiffs in plaintiffs' cases.
And it's not enough to I want to mention screenplays. If you're writing screenplays, it's not enough just to register your screenplay in Hollywood.
Well, you register it in the beginning, in the middle, in the end. Yeah. So I often have times when it's just kind of conceptual in the beginning, and we register that. There's no limitation how many times you can refile.
Yeah.
And so we'll get that in early to get an early date, and then we'll file derivative works on when it grows and changes, and then the final product. You might have 6 or 8 copyrights by the time it reaches public.
It's just like a patent. You start off with
so that nobody
else can jump in there.
Yeah.
And of course,
we always have one in the oven and one coming out of the oven.
That's right. Well, that's what you've done with my patents, and we're happy always that your guy there is always right on top of things because he is aware of what's happening, and that's so important.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, again, what is the organization that you belong to, and that anyone who is dealing with intellectual property. They have to use a lawyer, not their brother-in-law who is a real estate lawyer. Please don't do that. What is the group that you belong to?
AIPLA.org. Ton of free information there. That's all the intellectual property attorneys around the world. And so we're actually having a big meeting in January here in Tampa. So there'll be lawyers, IP lawyers from all over the world here in Tampa. Of course, our firm will be throwing, you know, cocktail parties and all that kind of stuff. So it's a fun group getting a whole bunch of patent attorneys together.
Oh,
let me tell
I'm
you,
sure.
Throw
real,
it down.
Real, really great. Well, you have to come back with some good stories.
I will.
Yeah, pick up some really fun stories.
But there's a lot of great information out there on the internet that I would encourage people to look at. If, you know, before you go running off to a lawyer and spend a bunch of money, go to AIPLA.org or go to the Copyright Office, which is LOC.gov, Library of Congress, Copyright Office website. There is a ton of free information, and it's well done. It's free. And it's comprehensive. So
and they
do your
should
research.
Contact you. So where? How do they get a hold of you?
LarsonPatentLaw.com is our website, and we have a form you can submit if you have questions or you need help, and then we'll give you a call back and see what we can do.
Okay. Well, Bill Larson of Larson & Larson, he's our legal eagle, and he comes in here every month to help us keep our heads straight about intellectual property, and it's so important. We call it intellectual property because it is has a value.
It's from the brain.
It's from the brain. It has value. Sometimes people
think
a lot
of value.
You know, it can have a great deal.
Sometimes the most value a company will have will be the intellectual property.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Well, thank you again, Bill, for coming in today.
My pleasure.
It's always a joy to see you. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Okay, great. Okay, I think we covered a nice bunch of stuff. We're going to have a commercial, and then I'll be right back with the two guests I have waiting for me. Okay, great.
This is the TAN Talk Radio Network.
Do you dread being called on to speak at meetings or family functions? Have you envied those who can sway an audience with well-chosen words? Do you know that people who speak well earn more money, earn more recording careers? Gain the confidence to master any speaking situation. Toastmasters will allow you to find your voice. Go to toastmasters.org to locate the club nearest you.
Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at LarsonPatentLaw.com.
How many of you listening today yearn to write stories, poems, or novels? Each of you has a story to tell, or knows of a story that others would love to read if only you could put the words on a page. The many writers' clubs in the Bay Area understand this urge and would welcome any new writer to learn with them. So go ahead and take the first step to becoming a well-known author. Sponsored by the Pinellas Writers Club.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Two guests in the studio with me. It's going to be fun. First, I have Donna Perry. She has been here before, and we're going to talk about her tremendous success with The Muttcracker. And I fell in love with this book when I first saw it, and I am so happy that she's back. And then we have Andrea Hiotis, and she's back, and she came here not too long ago, and I was so impressed with her. And she was from where? What is the name of your group?
The Newport Richey Library Group.
Okay, the Newport Richey Library Group. And I have a poem that I want to play, and it is from one of your members who brought you down here, and I want to play her poem, and it's from Catherine Long. So let's just
play. We gathered together, taking our sweet time, working out a novel or busting a rhyme. It don't matter whether it's over the top, a strong bestseller, or a down market flop. The sharp point of it all is the call to write about what haunts our dreams and keeps us up at night. We ain't looking to win no fortune or fame, don't even care if they remember our name. Just one thing is able to give us that start, a love affair with words growing in our heart. You'll never stop it, can't make us drop it, just try to top it, yeah.
Yay. Okay, well, that's from Catherine, and she is one of the enthusiastic members of your wonderful Newport Richey group, and you meet on
Monday nights.
Monday nights, and it's a nice, large group of writers who encourage each other and help each other, and so I wanted to bring Andrea back because I found her books just adorable, and but first let's talk a little to Donna. Donna, this is wonderful. What's happening to you, huh?
Oh, I've been having so much fun, especially this past weekend. I just got back from Birmingham, Alabama, where I actually saw a production of the Muttcracker Ballet.
Did I not predict it? Did I not predict it? I predicted this would happen because it is such a delightful story. And tell us about the production.
Well, I found out about it because I have a Google alert set up so that if there is any press that uses the words the Muttcracker in it, I would be informed. And I thought, well, this way I'll find out if somebody's writing a book review or one of the newspapers, you know, has something about my book. Well, last year, the Google alert came to my phone and I'm like, looking at it, it's from Birmingham, Alabama. I'm thinking, who's writing about me there? Well, they weren't writing about me. They were writing about Birmingham Ballet's production of the Muttcracker Ballet. Totally a coincidence, but there they are producing an actual ballet using dogs on stage. And I thought, how charming this is. I love it. So I contacted them and said, hey, I've got a book called The Muckraker. Let's collaborate. You're putting on this production. I've got the book. Maybe I can come to your production and sell it. And it didn't happen last year. This year, the executive director, Cindy Free, said, let's make it happen. And we did.
Well, I think that's exciting. And you sold some books there? Well,
I did. I, you know, if I had more time to plan, I could have had them shipped directly from the publisher. But I'm still green at this. So I packed them into my little rolling backpack, as many as I could tote. I brought them up there. And the production started at 7:30. The doors opened at 6:30. There was a boutique in the lobby selling all kinds of nutcracker-related items, as well as my Muckraker book. And I sold out before the curtain rose.
Well, I think, and I said to you as soon as I saw this book, that I feel there's a tremendous potential for production every year, it will become a classic. And I'm not sure, now you just heard we had Bill Larson in here talking about intellectual property. And it is very important, I feel, that you should get out there and really control it, because I can see this being produced all across the country, all across the world. And it is an opportunity, I think, for you to really cash in a big way on your characters and how you've developed. Your story is delightful. Your characters are delightful. And I just think, you know, when an author has come out with something so cute. Somebody left their cell phone on. Oh, that's funny. Good. It's not me. Okay. Andrea's up there and running, looking for her cell phone. This is funny. Okay. I did this once. That's all right, Andrea. I did it once, too. Do you like Andrea or do you like Andrea?
Andrea.
You like Andrea
Thank
better.
You.
It depends who I'm talking to. I'm talking to British people. I'm going around saying Andrea.
And my mother's British, but she says Andrea.
She says Andrea. Okay. Well, we'll do Andrea. Well, Andrea had her cell phone on. That's all right. I did it once when I was talking to CJ Box. I said, okay, well, it's a fan calling. What can I do, CJ? okay, so we're back to Donna for a minute. Because, Donna, you know, I like your book.
Well, I like it too, and I'd like to see it gain some momentum in other ways. Like I said, I think on my first visit, my dream was to see an animated feature up on the screen. And now that I see the Nutcracker and the Four Realms out there on the big screen, I'm thinking, why can't we have a Muckraker out there on the big screen?
Well, I think so. And I think, you know, one of the things is it's up to authors today to take charge of their careers. And it doesn't matter, even if you have a big-time agent, it's your job, because you can't just be having the fun of writing, which is the fun part. Mm-hmm. The business side, because it is a business, is investing in yourself, whether it's investing, for example, as we were talking with Bill Larson, in protecting your intellectual property, or trademarking your characters, so that if you want to make dolls out of your characters, or if you want, just like Mickey Mouse and Minnie Mouse and Donald Duck are protected characters, you have to protect those characters. It's up to you. It's an investment. Just like if you have a cupcake bakery, or what did you have, Andrea, you had some kind of business, a florist. So
yes.
You have to invest. You have to get the right legal papers. You had to get the right promotional materials. And you had to make sure that you went out there and sold yourself. And authors have to do the same thing. And that's why I wanted Donna in here today, because I think it's wonderful. And I, for myself, first of all, I love live stage. I love live performances. I think this should happen. I mean, this is a perfect for every school, for schools to do this story, mm-hmm. For local ballets to do this story. it's a wonderful, wonderful product that you have, and you have to think of it as a product, and make sure that you protect it, because I would hate to see people just running off with it without telling you, without getting your permission.
Well, the muckraker itself, the term muckraker is pretty
common.
Common, yes.
But again, if one of the things, and we were talking here with Bill, is about making sure, perhaps doing a series where you're going to have a series, which is easier to protect, a series of stories. But whatever you do, it is important that you look at your potential and what you can do to protect your characters. And now with you, Andrea, you're writing, you're doing your own drawings, and
yes,
you're drawing yourself, and you're writing little stories. Now, one of the things why I wanted you in here, I know that you will take orders from people who want a story written about a particular, for a particular child.
Right.
Which I think is a delightful thing to do. It's one of the, I mean, it's a gift that will be treasured forever if somebody
does. They really love it. The kids love it when they see themselves in the story. And the mother gives me like three things that the kid likes, and then I make up a story. Like for my nephew's birthday the other day, I sent him one about robots because he loves robots and he loves racing cars. So I incorporated racing cars and a race on his birthday with the robots and the racing cars. And they loved it. And he's going to color it, and they're going to grow from it because the littlest one is only 4 still, and his oldest sister is 12. But they're ranging from ages 4 to 12, and there's 6 of them. They live in Ohio, and that's the way that they know me is through these stories.
And one of the things that they now your stories are essentially they're like coloring books, and then
right,
you personalize the stories
mm-hmm.
for people, which I think is wonderful. How do you feel? What's the feeling you get when you know a child is reading your story?
You know, I think for me the biggest thing is, I mean, I write because I love to write, but with my book, I want to get it into the hands of people who will love it. And for me, it could be the kids that are reading the book. It could be the adults who own the pets that are featured in the book, the different 15 brand or breeds of dogs that are featured. So when I see somebody open the book and recognize their pet and say, I have to buy this, or, oh, this is just like my daughter's
right,
fill-in-the-blank breed, and they relate to it because the pet in the book, the illustration, is spot on to the doggy
right,
they have back at home.
Right.
And that is just the greatest feeling to know that you've hit your target market perfectly.
Well, your stories are delightful. Your characters are delightful. And, you know, it's just must really make you feel good to know that people are enjoying these stories.
It does. It does. And the Muckraker Ballet that I went to see, although it's a totally separate production that was not generated specifically from my book, it's produced with the same love of animals and love of ballet that I have. And Cindy Free, the executive director there, did a marvelous job putting together the choreography that would blend the animals' talents. You know, this one can roll over, this one can twirl, this one can leap, and blend it into the actual professional ballet production, which I'm sure any dance director who has put on a ballet knows how much work that is, but to coordinate it with dogs on stage is just phenomenal. And it was a beautiful production, and the dogs, they came out later into the lobby, and I took some, you know, personal photos, and oh, it was just breathtaking to see these beautiful large Great Danes, German Shepherds, little tiny dancing poodles with tutus on. It was a lot of fun. A lot of fun.
And is this available on YouTube?
It was professionally videographed, and I haven't seen it yet, but I do believe that videos and photos will be forthcoming.
Okay, well, that's fantastic. Now, you've been writing for children, Donna, for...
Well, I wrote this in 2002, a very long time ago, mainly for my children. And when Andrea and I were talking earlier and I saw her books, I said, wow, this is kind of how I started out. I wrote books for specific people, my kids.
Right.
And I did the illustration. Now, I am no artist. Andrea is an excellent artist. But that's how I started out. And then when I retired, I decided this really needed to see the light of day, and I had it professionally illustrated and then self-published.
Now, what are you working on now?
I just finished writing, but I'm still working on whether it's going to be illustrated or whether it's going to be a chapter book. I finished writing the next ballet-type book with dogs, and it's called Romeo and Juliet, and it's about a tomcat and a sweet little bulldog who come from opposite sides of the tracks, and basically their families don't hang out with one another, but they manage to use their talents to bring together their community.
Well, it sounds to me like it needs illustrations. I think it just cries out for illustrations. I would love to see.
I think so, too. And, you know, one of the things that a self-published author has to think about when they're doing a children's book, if they can't illustrate it themselves, is the cost involved in getting it professionally illustrated, because that drives up the cost of your books and what you can sell them for. But when I look at The Muttcracker and what it looks like in its hardcover edition as a gift quality book, it was well worth it. People want the gift quality book. They don't want a paperback.
Oh, no.
In this particular
book. Oh, no. It is beautifully done. Well, talking about illustrator, hiring an illustrator. Now, you hired an illustrator, and was it a flat fee, or do you pay royalty to this illustrator?
No, it was a flat fee, and I own these images. So if I want to put them on T-shirts or make, plush characters out of them, I can do that. I haven't gone down that route just because it's keeping me busy in retirement.
But you don't have a trademark on them?
No.
I would suggest you not make plush characters or T-shirts yet until you have a trademark. Because really, I know people say, do I really need a trademark? I will tell you, I've done a lot of business in my life, and you will be sorry if you don't have a trademark on things that let's just say, a certain big country with billions of people, will just copy it like crazy, mm-hmm. without some protection. And there is power in having an American trademark.
Mm-hmm.
An Australian writer who. wrote to me because it's funny, I have listeners in all sorts of countries, including the Ukraine. Hello. I have to learn how to say hello in Ukrainian. I had no idea I had listeners in Ukraine. I get this fan mail from the Ukraine, but an author from Australia wrote books, children's books, and then discovered, and she in Australia, it's easier to self-publish and send directly to a company with the billions of people. And they printed her book in English. You know, Australian English, I guess. G'day, g'day. You know. So she was very happy she had her book published. And beautiful, beautiful illustrations. And then she discovered they were publishing it in every country that... Yeah, they published it in Uzbekistan and Kyrgyzstan and this one. And she only accidentally, and somebody went to Romania and said, and came back from a visit in Romania, came to Australia and said, wow, I didn't know you were already published in Romania. And she said, what?
Wow.
I'm published in Romania. I didn't know I'm published in Romania. And so what happened is they didn't buy it in Romanian. They thought she already had her Romanian copy. Mm. And so eventually she got from somebody from the embassy, an Australian embassy in Romania, to buy her And there she is, her illustrations, her hand-drawn illustrations, everything in exactly, but translated wow. into Romanian. And then later she discovered every other language. So you do have to have protections, particularly yeah. in her case, because she did plan to do, you know, figurine type of things. Mm-hmm. They're girl books, dolls and stuff like that. And she's like, I don't know what's happening. So you do have to protect yourself. Mm-hmm. But you still, you know, and you don't want to get too depressed about it. But again, as I said, it's a business. And so we're now at the library. You have yeah. lots of wonderful people at the library. What are you doing at the library with the children's section?
I just talked to Catherine last night about that. And we would like to start a workshop for children at least twice a year where we can have them come in and we can have them learn to write, you know, structure sentences a little bit better, maybe show them a few different things. I could show them how to make a box, like a thumbnail example of a story, how to put it together with some cartoons and a little conversation, and they can make their own stories. And we could have them get up and read their stories. And then she said maybe a critique. I'm not sort of for sure I want to critique them. I want them just to be enthusiastic about what they make and have that be their prize, what they make. You know, so maybe we're going to do that. We're affiliated with the library now, which is a recent thing, and we're really happy and excited about that.
Now, do either one of you belong to any of the organizations for children's authors?
I'd like to.
I just joined Society for Children's Book Writers and Illustrators.
That's what I would like
yes.
to join.
Yes, you have to join.
I do.
It is a wonderful group, and I've had quite a few authors on who belong, particularly several who from Oregon who belong. And they, one of the things that, as both of you know, yourself published, Donna, and you're self-publishing as you go along, and eventually I'm sure you'll want to do something where you'll probably put it on Amazon as a self-published. If you're thinking, and what I want to do is at some point I want to get a whole bunch of you authors who write for children's books together and talk about the process of finding an agent, because the wonderful thing about having an agent is that they have access to really, really wonderful publishing groups that publish books that are, you know, so terrific as gift books. So, but it's not easy. And I highly recommend, and I would love, and I'm trying to get an agent or an agency that will come and do a workshop here in our area. But it is important that you try to attend some of the workshops where agents for children's books attend. I've mentioned to, I think maybe to both of you, that Andrea Brown has the best agency for children's books. She's in San Francisco. She's one of the few very, very big agents who has been able to move out of New York. Mm-hmm. Still most literary agents are in New York because that's where the publishers are, and that's where they can have lunch with them and, you know, and see them and pick up the phone and talk to them. And Andrea is one of the few who was so big and so important that she could move all the way to San Francisco, and that's quite a few years ago now, but she can still pick up the phone and talk to any publisher and simply say, this book is ready to go, take it. Mm-hmm. And she gets a deal. She runs two workshops a year. Her biggest one is Big Sur, which is in December. It's too late to go to that one. She has another one in the fall, in the spring in Cape Cod. And again, as we talked about, it's an investment. Children's authors really need to make, and all authors, but particularly children's writers, because at these workshops where you meet real, real important agents, this is the way to get. I know a couple of authors who have gone to these workshops. Well, Andrea Brown's, I think she has done like maybe 700 deals from her workshops over the past 10 years or so. And she gets six-figure advances for children's book authors. But it's up to you to actually attend some of these and get to know the agents. So a workshop is a wonderful thing to do. So
I'm making a note of it.
The Florida Writers Association conference I go to annually, and they always have an array of agents or publishers that will put on presentations there
The ones that are the best are the intimate workshops,
actual
where you're
workshops.
Working with maybe, you know, there's 30, 40 authors and at least three or four really great agents and other editors and other people. Those are the ones that you have to aim for and you should look out for.
Okay.
And I will start putting those on my website. In January, I'm expanding my website, so I'll have that kind of stuff to help you. Anyway, girls, it was great. Oh, can I say girls? Are we? I don't know. I'm so politically incorrect today. ladies, children's authors. Okay, Donna Perry, how can people find out more about you? Website?
Well, The Muckraker has its own Facebook page, okay. So if they get onto Facebook and look for The Muckraker, and if they want to buy books on Amazon, the easiest way is to search The Muckraker by Donna Perry, P-A-R-R-E-Y.
That's it.
And
okay.
That'll go directly to the page.
Well, my work is being sold at the Paperback Book Exchange store on Ridge Road in Port Richey.
Okay.
So at least they are on sale there.
Okay. Well, we will stay in contact with you. And everybody else, I want to remind you that Carol J. Perry, spelled P-E-R-R-Y, her book Bell Spells and Murders is out. And it's a wonderful, it's a cozy, mystery Christmas read. A really great book. And also, I had Christine E. Blum on my program the other day. And I pronounced her name Bloom. Because I knew a guy named Philip Bloom, and he wanted, but he spelled it the same way with just Blum. But I feel so bad. I mispronounced her name, but it's Christine E. Blum, and her books are all about a wonderful wine club. They're wine club mysteries, and I love wine. And so you would want to read her books and have a glass of wine. It's just a perfect read. And I keep getting more and more books. I get so many books. I'm just so happy. Anyway, it's been a pleasure to have both of you in today.
Thank you. I want
to follow your careers because I think that you both have talent, and you never know where it will lead you. You know exactly, to a ballet or maybe to the someday being, you know, having your story as a cartoon on television. It's you never know. But it's up to you. And so just remember, one of the joys of life is to see your words on paper or to hear them spoken in an audible book. And the only way to do that is to make sure that you keep writing. And meanwhile, of course, it's very important, go to my webpage, radio-joyonpaper, and I will be posting these interviews and other interviews so that you can listen from stories from your favorite authors. So I have a lot of people coming up soon, and it's going to be lots of fun. Anyway, say something nice to somebody today. I will say something nice to Big Ed in the control room. Thank you, Ed. And he's saluting me, and I'm saluting him. Girls, salute Ed. Everybody salute Ed. Boom. Okay. Thanks, Ed.
Thank you, Patsy.
Thank you so much.
It was fun. Bye-bye.